Good morning, everyone. We're reading in Book 1, Canto 3, and we reached page 30, line 296. So we'll start reading today from the next line. All was revealed there, none can here express. We are reading about the yoga, the tapasya of King Aswapati, who will become the human father of Savitri. And in the first section of this canto, Sri Aurobindo has revealed him to us as a being from higher planes who has come to earth as a colonist from immortality. But nevertheless, since he has taken on the human form, taken a human birth, he has to go through the human process of finding his soul, and he follows a great quest to fulfill his mission. That quest of King Aswapati covers about half of the book. So we are just in the beginning of that now, and we are reading about how he has gained entrance to the subtle worlds. He has gained a power of subtle vision and subtle hearing and other subtle senses also. We read about the celestial fragrances that came to his nostrils and the honey of paradise that he could taste upon his tongue. You would start, please, Patty. Page 30, line 297.
All was revealed there, none can here express. Vision and dream were fables spoken by truth, or symbols more veridical than fact, or were truths enforced by supernatural seal. Immortal eyes approached and looked in his, and beings of many kingdoms neared and spoke. The ever-living, whom we name as dead, could leave their glory beyond death and birth to utter the wisdom which exceeds all phrase. The kings of evil and the kings of good, appellants at the reason's judgment seat, proclaim the gospel of their opposite, and all believe themselves spokesmen of God. The gods of light and titans of the dark battle for his soul as for a costly prize.
Thank you. Anyone would like to ask or share anything about the lines which Patty has read?
It's 109 supernatural seals.
I think this seal, it is the idea of the ruler, the person in authority. He puts his stamp, his seal on a document, and then that document has to be enforced. So here it is that the visions and dreams which Aswapati experiences are coming from that realm. It says they were either fables, that's meaningful stories, spoken by truth, truths expressed in story form or in the form of vision and dream, or they were symbols that are more veridical, more truth-telling. They express more truth than fact, than earthly fact. Or they were truths enforced by supernatural seals. There's an authority behind these truths that will be implemented, they will be enforced. They've got that mark of approval of truth on them.
Supernatural means both good and positive and negative, or good?
I think in this case it means more than natural, from a higher level than that of earthly fact. We always tend to think that that facts are true, but I don't believe that's the case that we have earthly facts, it is true, but there are supernatural truths which are much truer than what we call reality, what we call fact. They belong to a higher nature, the divine nature, not this evolutionary nature here. Yes, these are the eyes of immortal beings. These are experiences that he's having in his first encounter with the subtle world. So these immortal beings come, meet him, look at him. They even speak to him, you know, later on. Yes. Something to share, Tuan?
Experience when he's in jail.
That comes a little bit later, no? When it says, the ever-living, whom we name as dead, could leave their glory beyond death and birth to utter the wisdom which exceeds all phrase. When I read these lines, and when Tuan reads these lines, he thinks of one of Sri Aurobindo's experiences when he was in Alipur jail. He has told us about it, how the spirit of Vivekananda, who by then had left his body, one of the ever-living whom we name as dead, came to him and explained to him about all the many planes of existence. And Sri Aurobindo says that the spirit of Vivekananda came to him regularly every night over a period of about 2 weeks, I think, until he had made Sri Aurobindo understand about these planes. And then he stopped coming. And it was on the basis of this revelation that he received from Swami Vivekananda that Sri Aurobindo was able to reach the knowledge of the supermind, supramental plane.
I have another question about it.
Yes, Larry.
Sometimes we might have dreams of people who have passed away. Sometimes I mean, you know, my father or things like that that passed away long ago. So I wonder whether people in general, not just people can know this, but people in general still live somewhere.
I think that's for sure, yes. But whether they bother to come and share things with us, that may happen very occasionally, I think.
But they are in different bodies in their next lives. Unless they are,
but they may be these ever-living beings on the immortal planes, and they can come and communicate with us.
The question is about family, like,
if it is something recent, then it may well be the spirit coming and communicating. There was somebody in the ashram who seemed to have a special affinity with that world, and ashramites who left their bodies very often came and communicated with him. But if it's after a longer time, if it's after decades, then it's more likely to be some kind of knowledge about those people that you're holding in yourself and that comes to you through the subliminal in sleep. So it's only a partial incarnation?
Yes.
Part of you remains on those immortal planes.
I think it depends on the part of the being that's united around the soul. That part would be immortal. The rest of it, the ordinary people, I think they don't remain intact for very long. They dissolve and become a totally different personality. That's my understanding.
So, but King Asvapati had this experience of ever-living beings whom we consider to be dead, they came to King Asvapati to share wisdom with him, wisdom that cannot be fully expressed in words, in phrases. No? And another thing that happens is this battle for his soul. No? The kings of evil and the kings of good, they are appellants at the reason's judgment seat. It's like in a court, these kings of evil and these kings of good, they are stating their case and trying to win over the approval of his reason. They're proclaiming the gospel of their opposites. And those beings believe themselves to be or express themselves as spokesmen of God. So he has to have discernment to be able to distinguish between them. They are battling for his soul as for a costly prize. If his reason accepts their argument, that will be a great victory for them. And he's aware of this battle going on. Perhaps for all of us it is happening to a greater or lesser extent. But we're not always aware of the way that the kings of evil and the kings of good are battling for the approval of our reason and the assent of our soul. Shall we read on? Yes, please.
In every hour loosed from the quiver of time, there rose a song of new discovery, a bow twang's hum of young experiment. Each day was a spiritual romance, as if he was born into a bright new world, adventure leaped in an unexpected friend, and danger brought a keen, sweet tang of joy. Each happening was a deep experience. There were high encounters, epic colloquies, and the councils came couched in celestial speech, and honeyed pleadings breathed from occult lips to help the heart to yield to rapturous call, and sweet temptations stole from beauty's realms, and sudden ecstasies from a world of bliss. There was a region of wonder and delight.
Thank you. In every hour loosed from the quiver of time. Quiver is one of these many words in Savitri, which has a double meaning, or has two separate meanings in this case. A quiver is a little movement of fear or delight, a little trembling, leaves quiver in the wind. But this has nothing to do with that. This is the quiver, the container for the archer's arrows. The archer has a container he wears on his shoulder where he has his arrows in, and when he wants to shoot an arrow, he pulls it out, puts it to his bow, and looses it. So Sri Aurobindo here is experiencing the hours which King Asvapati experiences. In every hour loosed from the quiver of time, there arose a song of new discovery. As the bow lets loose the arrow, the sound of the bow string and the arrow flying off, this makes a song of new discovery, something new and exciting. A bow twangs hum of young experiment. What is it called? The rope of the bow. When you pull it back and let go, it twangs, it gives a sound. No? And the arrow itself makes a sound. So this is something very exciting, a song of new discovery. A bow twangs, hum, I think it reverberates. It's a song of young experiment, something new and exciting. So in that day, with that way, every day, each day, was a spiritual romance, a romance in the original meaning of the word, which is of a collection of exciting, unpredictable adventures, unusual and fantastic adventures. Nowadays we use the word more for a love story, but that the original romances were adventure stories of people on journeys having unexpected encounters. Sri Aurobindo is obviously using it in that sense here. For Aswapurti, it's as if he's been born into a bright new world, and in that world there are adventures, and adventures come unexpectedly, but as an unexpected friend. Danger, the danger of those adventures and those experiences brings a special flavor of delight, a keen, sweet tang of joy. Keen means sharp, no? And a tang is a rather sharp taste. Lemon juice, perhaps, but this is also sweet, keen, sweet tang of joy. The danger is a challenge and something exciting and enjoyable. In that world, each happening was a deep experience. So there he meets beings. There were high encounters with noble and magnificent beings, and epic colloquies. A colloquy is a conversation, usually between two people. This is something on a very high and noble scale. And counsels came, advice couched in celestial speech. It's as if heavenly beings are guiding and advising him. And he experiences, he hears, honeyed pleadings breathed from occult lips, sweet voices inviting him, no, to help the heart to yield to rapture's call, to the call of intense delight. And sweet temptations stole from beauty's realm. They come to him unobtrusively, creeping in, coming from the realms of beauty, and sudden ecstasies come to him from a world of bliss. So this realm he has entered now, it is a region of wonder and delight. Anshal, would you read?
Do we start at line 228?
Yes. 227.
On now, this bright and clear audience could receive a contact thrill of mighty unknown things, awakened to new unearthly closenesses, the touch replied to subtle infinities, and with a silver cry of opening gates, sight's lightnings leaped into the invisible. Ever in this consciousness and vision pool, they took an ampler sweep, a loftier flight. He passed the border marked for matter's rule, and passed the zone where thought replaces life.
Thank you. All these experiences are the result of the development in him, the growth in him, of subtle senses. So one of these subtle senses is clairaudience. We're familiar with the word clairvoyance. People who can see at a distance or into the subtle worlds can see auras, perhaps. This is subtle hearing, which has now developed so that he can receive all different kinds of subtle sounds. And there's also a new sense of touch, a contact thrilled of mighty unknown things. He's able to feel the touch, the contact of those mighty unknown things. The sense of touch is awakened to new unearthly closenesses, to the closeness of immaterial things that don't belong to our earthly senses. And that touch can even respond to subtle infinities, limitless regions, and a new sense of sight opens up with a silver cry of opening gates. Sights, lightnings leaped into the invisible. It's as if a wonderful silver gateway into the invisible world opens up with a very special sound, because these gates are made of silver. And if it's an iron gate, it may open with a kind of creak, no? But a silver cry of opening gates, his sight is able to leap into the worlds that are normally invisible to us. And as a result of this, his consciousness and his power of vision are constantly growing. They are taking on an ampler sweep. He can see a greater range of things, and they take a loftier flight, rising up to higher and higher levels of consciousness. So he, in his consciousness, Aswapati, passed the border marked for matter's rule. That there's a kind of borderline. Matter rules. Matter may also have its subtler aspects, but he goes beyond that borderline, and he passes the zone of thought, the zone where thought replaces life. He's moved higher than that. Later on in book two, we shall be able to follow King Aswapati as he systematically explores these realms, from the world of subtle matter to the different levels of life, the different levels of mind, and beyond mind. But here, at this stage, it is as if he's getting from time to time experiences that pass beyond these borders.
You know, this art replaces another zone, it's not
really. Well, there's the realm of matter, there's the realm of life, and there's the realm of thought. Sri Aurobindo has very concisely expressed that King Aswapati not only passes beyond the realm of matter, but also the realm of life and of thought, and gone beyond. He's mentioned all the three without going into detail.
In Ajanta 1962, Mother described to Supreme, his consciousness is in 2000. The consciousness of the mother is in 2000. And she tell, I have vision, I prepare. It's very, very, very interesting. But here, Mother, his consciousness go, not stay in the moment, but living so
far ahead.
And maybe he prepared 2000. It was that when Kirik came in Aurobindo, he told me it's a time of Shakti for the prepared room. Yes, maybe mother prepared.
Yes. Thank you.
I correlate when I discover my agenda.
Thank you.
May I say something?
Yes, please, Duan.
There are two things which hit me after this passage. It's very long that he talks about this, but at the end he calls clear audience. It was a total surprise for him. As a matter of fact, I never read other writers writing about this so strongly. And second, when he, at the end, he sums up all those senses, the smell is missing.
But it comes at the top of page.
Yeah?
It comes at the top of page 29, second line. in the nostrils quivered celestial fragrances. On the tongue.
Anyway, he does not list it anymore.
No, he doesn't mention it again. No. I think perhaps in book 11 he does. But he speaks a lot about the subtle hearing.
Yes. Which surprised.
Several pages, yes. And now a new stage. You would read, sir?
Yeah. Out of this world of signs, suddenly he came into a silent self where world was not, and looked beyond into a nameless vast. These symbol figures lost their right to live. All tokens dropped. Our sense can recognize. There the heart beat no more at body's touch. There the eyes gaze no more on beauty's shape. In rare and lucent intervals of hush, into a signless region he could soar, packed with the deep contents of formlessness, where world was into a single being wrapped, and all was known by the light of identity, and spirit was its own self-evident.
Thank you. Even the subtle worlds are a world of signs. There are forms, symbol movements. But suddenly, King Asvapati enters or finds himself in a state of silent self where there is no world, and he's looking even further into a vastness where there are no names, no forms.
World of signs, please.
This is a world of signs. Everything here is a sign of something else. No? And our senses pass these signs on to us. But Sri Aurobindo is describing a world where there are no signs. Mother has said that those special beings who leave this world of signs and enter that world, they experience it at first as a total emptying, a blankness. But she said, actually it's not like that. That is the reaction of the consciousness which is used to sign. That realm of formlessness, here he says it, is packed with the deep contents of formlessness. The infinite potentialities that are not yet, or that may be expressed in form, but there their formless origin is.
Is that the experience of moksha?
Moksha means liberation. And there are, I think, different kinds of liberation. There's the liberation from ignorance, when the consciousness gains the higher knowledge. Something of that is suggested here when it says all was known by the light of identity and spirit was its own self-evidence. I can't say more than that. Sorry? This is only a momentary experience that he is having. Later on, we shall see that he enters the self of mind in book 2, this canto 13. And there it seems as if he's reached a kind of total liberation. But for King Asvapati, that is not the end of the journey.
This must be what it feels like in Nepal. No? He's from Nepal, he's from Chandra, the Himalayan region, no? Mm. This nameless vast, Isn't it? That's like that's the place on earth where it's touching.
So surely it's felt that that's the highest region we can attain on earth. Yes. But this is obviously beyond this earthly material sphere. Well, this canto is called the Yoga of the Soul's Release. So I think these are experiences which Asvapati is having as the inner being grows and widens and becomes more refined and subtleized. He's getting glimpses of many different kinds of experience. And finally, he does experience the release of the soul at the end of the canto. That's another kind of moksha, no? It's the release from the cycle of birth and rebirth. Anyway, here it's important for us to stick to the text. I think what we are receiving is evocations of experiences that may happen as the subtle being comes more into our awareness, as the consciousness deepens. And as I mentioned before, these are all experiences which Sri Aurobindo had and which he has recorded in one way or another here and there, as well as here in Savitri. Perhaps this is the most detailed record of his own experience. So this, where he has this experience he's had now, this of a silent self where all was known by the light of identity, of identification, and spirit was its own self-evidence. It doesn't have to prove or explain anything. There is just a spontaneous knowledge of the truths of the spirit. Mr. Motti? Thank you.
It's interesting that this is from the perspective of the soul's experience, it seems to me. In Buddhism, I know we should keep the text, they don't believe in the soul, we're told, but they still retain this formlessness without the soul.
Yes.
So I suppose what I'm asking is, what part does the soul play in attaining
to the infinite.
Well, to moksha, to
yes.
These higher levels where the ego dissolves.
As I understand what Sri Aurobindo and the Mother have told us, our true soul, our soul in its origin, is infinite and eternal, and a portion of that one, this single being, into whom everything, all the manifestations of the world are wrapped in this experience of King Asvapati. It's as if he's touching the origin. And there, everything can be known, not as an object, but subjectively by identity. And these next lines, which Mr. Motti read, they are elaborating on that experience. Asvapati feels the supreme, the one, the origin, looking through his human eyes and seeing all things and all creatures as itself, as emanations, as expressions of itself. And thus he knows all thought and word as its own voice, the one experiencing himself expressed in all the manifestations of the world. Since we are that and have come from that, it is possible for us to find it in ourselves, to do that, unless it just comes by grace, unless it comes as it comes to King Aswapati because of the preparation of many previous lives and experiences on higher planes. We had a recent darshan message. Mother says this can be reached through concentration and introspection. And when we reach that true center of the Supreme, then we know that it is one in all beings. And then that is a liberation from the separate ego, a liberation from many human attitudes and ways of experiencing things. Does that answer your question? No. In a way, the soul, this divine spark in us, which is using evolution to express itself more and more in the material world, is our guide in the inner search. I don't mean that Buddhists can't reach that goal. I don't know whether they can or not.
When you struck at the end of the show, the soul becomes the protagonist. Your consciousness is seen through, it sees through the soul. Yeah. And the soul gives you unity feeling and identity feeling, contemporarily. And you reflect it in your mind and make a thought from it, make a picture of it. From that sense, you have to identify with the divine standing.
There's a certain mantric power in these lines, which if we focus on them and repeat them, they can bring us closer to the experience which is being expressed, more than we can do by discussing. I only try to explain linguistic difficulties, or sometimes the imagery and things like that. Otherwise, Sri Aurobindo has to do his work through the lines of the poem. Shall we read on, Bessie? It's the last line on page 31. Their unity. We haven't read the last line at the bottom of page 31.
We have.
We have.
I do it again, it's so good. Yeah, it's worth it. Let's do it again.
Oh.
Their unity is too close for search and doubt. And love is yearning the one for the one. And beauty is the sweet difference of the soul. And oneness is the soul of multitude. There all the truths unite in a single truth, and all ideas rejoin reality. There, knowing herself by her own eternal self, wisdom, supernal, wordless, absolute, set uncompanioned in the eternal calm, all seeing, motionless, and alone. There, knowledge means not words to embody idea. Idea seeking a house and boundlessness, weary of eternal immortality. Ask not in God's carved brilliant cell to rest, whose single windows clipped outlook on things. Sees only a little art while there, one can be wider than the world. While there, one is one's own infinity.
Thank you. There, that is in this state of silent self, where world is not there. Unity is too close for search and class. But there is still love. Love is a yearning of the one for the one. And beauty is a sweet difference of the same. And oneness is the soul of multitude. There, all the truths unite in a single truth, and all ideas rejoin reality. There, knowing herself by her own termless self, wisdom supernal, wordless, absolute, sat uncompanioned in the eternal calm, all-seeing, motionless, sovereign and alone. There, knowledge needs not words to embody idea. Idea seeking a house in boundlessness, weary of its homeless immortality, asks not in thought's carved brilliant cell to rest, whose single windows, clipped outlook on things, sees only a little arc of God's vast sky. This not in line 366 negates the whole sentence. Idea is not us seeking for a house in boundlessness, and it's not weary of its homeless immortality. And so it doesn't seek a home in thought, that very narrow, small room with a single window. It's brilliant and it's wonderfully carved with images, but it can only look out to a very limited arc of the vast sky of God. But in that realm where he is now, that is not happening. The boundless with the boundless there consorts. There's a meeting, communication and exchange of between boundlessness. While there, in that state, one can be wider than the world. While there, one is one's own infinity. First, the experience of the oneness and of being united with the Supreme. Several different aspects of oneness, of the unity, and then the experience of how all the many conflicting truths of the world in that realm unite in a single truth, and all ideas reconnect with the one reality which is their origin. That is the home of the supernal wisdom, the prajna, that is the origin of the manifestation. There, knowledge needs not words to embody idea. I'm reminded of a talk of the mother to some of the teenagers of the ashram, where she pointed out how we usually think with words, and she says, sometimes we don't even know what we are thinking until we put it into words, either in speech to other people or we note it down. But she says there's a higher level than those words, that speech in the mind. There's a level of idea where we can contact, whole ideas, if we don't hurry to put them into words, to express them in words, if we can just hold them as ideas, we find that they can be expressed in many different ways of words, forms of words. And if we can learn to think like that, when an idea comes, we can let it choose its own form of words, and that will be more effective than anything that we could manufacture for them in our mind. But beyond the realm of ideas, she says, there is the realm of experience. And one should learn eventually to think in experiences. I think first comes experience. It takes a form of knowledge in the consciousness that may express itself as word, and then could come down into the mind as a form of word. Concept and idea perhaps are synonymous.
Here the I is capital.
Yes. Yes. So he's thinking of this high realm of conceptive, creative thought.
So are you saying the words actually represent experiences at the highest level? For example, love. Love is a word, but it is an experience in its supreme state.
Love is a truth and a reality to which we have put a label. Perhaps the experience can be expressed without that label in many other ways, and not necessarily even in words, in other ways. Shall we just read a little further? Chitra? Thank you. His center was no more in earthly mind. Most of us are centered up here most of the time when we're not centered down here. He has gone beyond that limitation. And what happens is that a power of seeing silence filled his limbs. If you take the trouble to observe yourself in contemplation, in meditation, you may notice how much the whole body is affected by the tension of thought, and that if the mind falls silent, or if you come out of the mind, if the consciousness comes out of the mind, that's a tremendous relief to the body, to all the parts of the body. It's something like that, that instead of this thought atmosphere filling his body, it's this power of silence, silence that has vision, that can see, that is conscious, power of seeing silence filled his limbs. And in that state, he suddenly caught by a voiceless white epiphany. Anybody would like to give a definition of the word epiphany?
Part of the story or poem where the truth comes out. The real truth comes out.
the revelation.
It's something like a revelation or a darshan. It's a revelation of divinity. In the Christian church, they celebrate a particular date as Epiphany, and the church calendar starts from that. That's the day when the baby Jesus was recognized as the Messiah. So it's like something like the divinity revealing itself. So here it's as if he's seized by this revelation of divinity that without words carries him into a vision that's beyond all forms and a living experience that surpasses the life that we know. He's carried up, he neared the still consciousness, that unmoving, immobile consciousness that supports everything. So this voice that only by speech can move the mind is transformed into a silent knowledge in the soul. And the strength, the dynamism of life that can only feel its own truth in action is now lodged, it's fixed, it's held in a mute, omnipotent peace. And in that silence and stillness, Asvapati experiences a pause, a leisure in the labor of the worlds, as if all the effort and energy, movements of energy that are going on in the universe, as if it all stops, a pause in the joy and anguish of the search, restored the stress of nature, that pressure and constant impulsion of nature to God's calm. Everything becomes quiet. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. All the conflicting and contradictory impulses and movements and urges, everything falls into complete agreement. A vast unanimity ended life's debate. I think that's where we'll stop for today. Next, Sri Aurobindo gives a list of all the things that stop in that vast unanimity. We'll read it next week. We'll listen to Mother.
And the King of Buddha, apparent and joined earth, blood, mud, sea, proclaimed the gospel of their offering, and all believed themselves spokesmen of God, the God of light and titans of the dark, better for his soul as for the cause of Christ. There, knowing herself by her own curveless self, wisdom supernal, wordless absolute, sat and companion in the eternal calm, all-seeing, motionless, sovereign and alone. A note pull of subconscious cause renews, it draws the unwilling spirit from the height of a dull gravitation, drags us down to the blind, driven inertia of our base. This too, the supreme diplomat can do. He makes greater height.
Thanks to Shobindra.